Hi everyone, welcome to the Tech Entrepreneur on a Mission podcast. My name is Ton Dobbe and I'm the founder of Value Inspiration and the author of The Remarkable Effect. I envision a world where every B2B SaaS startup succeeds because they're creating software that customers would miss if they were gone. And here's why. Research consistently shows that 90% of all startups fail, and that's bad. What's worse, however, is that 75% of SaaS scale-ups fail, companies that are supposed to have product market fit. Far too few scale-ups create the traction they aspire for and fail for the wrong reasons. And I believe this should stop, and hence I created my business. And the goal that I have with this podcast is twofold. First, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential that we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. Secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what it requires to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. The guest on my podcast this week is Krishna Rajaraja, CEO of Support Logic.
If customers are excited and investors are not seeing it, this is the right opportunity to go after, because this is an opportunity that they're not going to fund. Not many companies are going to enter the market, and which means it's a huge advantage that you have as an entrepreneur to go conquer the market.
This is Raja. From his early days as one of VMware's first support engineers, Krishna discovered something that the industry had missed. The most valuable customer insights were being lost in departmental silos. Yet instead of accepting conventional solutions, he chose to build something the market initially rejected, but customers immediately embraced. And this inspired me, and hence I invited Krishna to my podcast. We explore the counterintuitive approach of building a B2B software company by deliberately ignoring what investors and the market considered essential. His journey reveals how challenging established industry assumptions can uncover massive business opportunities that others miss, while on the other end creating natural barriers to competition through a unique product philosophy. By listening to this podcast, you will learn four things. Firstly, how to identify massive market opportunities in the disconnect between investors' skepticism and customer excitement. Secondly, by focusing on six wildly successful customers, yield better results than chasing rapid scale. Thirdly, when deliberately ignoring industry must-haves, create stronger market positioning. And lastly, how to turn early customer enthusiasm into effortless enterprise sales. Well, hi, Krishna. Thank you for making your time available today and being the guest on the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Ton.
It's a pleasure. It's been a while since I have had a software vendor that is specialized in the customer support area. So it was about time. And when I got introduced to your company, Support Logic, and I saw the vision behind it and what you tried to solve, I was like, yeah, I like that. It's something that's worth having a conversation about. But before start talking about the whole journey that you've been through with founding the company and bringing it to where you are today, what drives you? What do you get energy from?
Yeah, it's a great question. I would say most entrepreneurs would say the same thing. So it's no different for me. I'm driven by curiosity, driven by learning something new, and nothing teaches you more like an entrepreneurship. You're learning something new every day. So that's what drives me, always trying to understand why the world works the way it works, what can be done to improve it.
Fascinating. I mean, it's not a new one to me. As a matter of fact, I wrote my book, The Remarkable Effect, and that's about the 10 traits that define remarkable software companies. Trait number four is they master curiosity. So there you go. Without that, it's going to be a tough journey, I can tell you. So, I mean, I think I got some questions around it later on. But let's first get started with how it all started. You started the business 2016, as far as I can peel back. What was the big idea behind the business? What was the problem that was screaming for a solution like yours?
Yeah, the company was incorporated in 2016, but actually was started in 2018. I was sabbatical and doing part-time for 1.5 years. But the genesis of the company comes from my first job, real job, at a company called VMware. This is back in 2002. I was an operating system engineer until then. I was always fascinated by how operating system worked, the interconnection between software and hardware. So operating system was my passion. And this company, VMware, was doing something really phenomenal technology in that space, in the operating system space. So I was very, very intrigued when they approached me and offered me a job, but to my disappointment, it was a support job. I was like, why would I do support? And their pitch to me was, look, the product is used by all operating system engineers all over the world. We want somebody with operating system expertise to support our customers. And that pitch made a lot of sense because I felt like I'm going to learn from all these experts all over the world. I'm going to help them with any technical issues. And also the technical issues were super complex when you're dealing with operating systems and operating system and hardware layer. So I took the job and then ended up really, really liking it to my surprise. And I found the interconnection between technology and humanity and how technology gloriously fails in front of humanity completely fascinating to me. And I realized, as much as I'm a technology person, I realized that when people are having a technical issue, they're less concerned about the technical issue. They're more concerned about what they want to do with the product, what is their end goal is, right? So when you're supporting your customers, if your focus turns towards the end goal of what the customer is trying to accomplish, you can actually give them a much better support than just merely focused on the technical issue. The engineering mind in me always is fascinated by the things breaks because you know, they say that the best way to learn something is by breaking it. Right? We learn about the universe by breaking the atoms and creating all these particles from atoms and understanding how the universe works. That's how you understand about technology. Technology, when it fails, that's when you truly understand it, how the technology works. So that part was interesting for me, but also simultaneously, the psychology of dealing with customers and customer emotions and solving the real problems and becoming their hero when you're solving their problems really, really fascinated. So I learned a lot in that process. That's what led me to start Support Logic.
Fascinating. Well, I mean, I saw that you indeed were the first engineer of VMware. Well, one of the first, and that you helped scale their support function globally. So you actually kept going there for a long while, and it speaks to you about putting your teeth into that and making it work. So then you've incorporated the company in 2016, but actually got it going in 2018, which is 16 years down the road. What is the opportunity? What was the end goal or the outcome that you had in mind? Tell me a little bit about the vision behind it. What is the change that you try to create here?
So when I was doing support and VMware was a small startup at the time, less than 100 people, support team had like five people. And then company quickly became a rocket ship and was growing like crazy. And which means more customers, more unhappy customers, more support issues, so on and so forth. And what I found out was in every customer interaction that I had, I learned something about what the customer truly want in the product, what feature functionality they want in the product that doesn't exist, what upsell cross-sell opportunities that this customer potentially has that needs to be fulfilled. Is this a customer is going to churn or they're going to remain as a loyal customer? All of the signals were there when in my conversations with them, in servicing them. But all the signals were dropped on the floor because my goal as a support engineer was only solve issues. So I always felt like, you know what, I need to carry the signals to different functional groups within VMware. So literally I would run building to building because the support group was a separate building in Palo Alto. And then the building across was the engineering group, building across was the product group. So I would just run building to building and say, hey, look, this is what I learned from this, all my support interactions that I've had this week. Maybe product team, you have to prioritize this. Maybe product marketing, you want to position the product a little differently. Maybe the sales team, maybe this is an account at risk, right? I had all the signals and the knowledge, but I was the one who was interpreting that from the interactions and sharing the knowledge. So this kind of lodged into my brain, like why this is a problem that is not solved by companies, why we rely on human beings to solve this. And I think the time I realized the fundamental challenge is we're all really good at capturing customer interactions. We have CRM software. CRM software has been there since early 2000s, right? We've been really good at capturing information, but we didn't do anything to with it. All we were relying on is human beings to process that, understand that, and make sense of it. The CRM system was a dumb database in the cloud. That's all it was, right? So thought process, what if we make the systems of record that keeps your customer interactions, make them a system of intelligence? What if they start introspecting everything that gets stored in it, make sense out of it, keep context, and provide recommendations, right? How could this come fundamentally transform a business? Because I would say the most important resource a company has is their communication with their customers. Because if you don't pay close attention to it, you're out of business. Not only today, I mean, you may miss future opportunities, or you may just completely be blindsided in the market. So you have to pay very, very close attention to that. So that's the aha moment. I realized, okay, this is an area of opportunity to disrupt. And that's what led me to start Support Logic.
Exactly. I mean, what I saw is that your mantra is customer support shouldn't be just a cost center, but a strategic driver for growth. And this is, explaining
Right.
how you see that. And I agree. It's almost stupid that it's kept in a silo and nothing is done with it.
I think there's one example I would just want to highlight here, Don, which is very, very relevant here. And I actually written this in my book. I wrote a book called Support Experience. And in that book, I talk about this. So there is, we all know Nokia smartphones, such a popular smartphones, right? And then within a relatively short span of time, they completely lost their market share to Apple smartphones, right? And Apple and then the Android smartphones. But if you look at Nokia at its peak, they had lots of data about their customers. There are lots of information about how customers are using it. And if you go ask all their customers, they will actually send surveys and ask the customers, what do you want? Every customer would say, I want more battery life, much more smaller compact phones, and much more cheaper phones. That's what every customer wanted. That's their cash cow. That's how the market was built, right? But they completely missed an emerging trend. An emerging trend there is that customers actually wanted smartphones. And even developing countries where affordability of smartphones was very difficult, they're willing to pay for smartphones. And that information is not voluminous data. It is what we call as thick data, right? Very few emerging voices. And if you don't pay close attention to the voices, you're out of business. So this is the value that you find in customer interactions. There's lots of signals in customer interaction that needs to be mined, processed, and harnessed. And this is the reason we exist as a company. Like, how do we enable companies to do this at scale?
Yeah, fascinating. Yeah, I saw that who you're targeting, and it's typically global enterprises. And of course, the more people you have, the more people that have contact with customers. Yeah, the more it gets lost in translation almost. Then you start in 2018. You start building. You do interviews. You understand what you need to build. You make your bets. And of course, at that point in time, I think AI was still in its early days. Although it was around. There's so many choices that you can make technology-wise. What has been an early choice, an early decision that you took that has appeared to be very important for the success that you see today?
I think every startup which is creating something new, not cheaper alternative for an existing category, but a brand new category, if a company is creating that, you need to have a point of view, a philosophy that is different from what's out there. That point of view and philosophy is what makes a significant difference for companies, foundational difference for companies in the long run. And the point of view that I took for Support Logic is that, as you already pointed out earlier, we fundamentally believe that support is not a cost center. Support should not be seen as a tactical organization where you are just focusing on solving one issue and going on to the next issue and so on and so forth. It needs to be much more strategic for a company. And that's a fundamental view, a viewpoint we took. What this means is we decided not to do certain things that the industry was doing in the early days. For example, all the tools that we found in the support ecosystem back in 2016 or 2018, or the decade prior to that, they're all focused on one problem, which is case deflection. That's it. And the entire idea was, let's put chatbots, let's put knowledge base, let's deflect the cases. And if you deflect the cases, support doesn't have to deal with cases because you don't want support to handle cases. It's a cost center. You don't want them to handle a lot of cases. And
Exactly.
we fundamentally took a very different approach. And the approach was, if you start deflecting your cases continuously, and if you're not doing it in a sensible way, essentially you're deflecting your customers away. You're not learning from those customer interactions, right? You're putting band-aid to problem over and over and really not fixing the fundamental issue, right? So that's a fundamental approach we took. And this was a little of a challenge for us because when we went and raised money, there was no comparables at the time. Like everyone was, oh, what are you doing? You're not doing chatbot, you're not doing case deflection. What is this? What are you doing then, right?
Let me make a small interruption here. Krishna has made an excellent remark that sets his solution apart from conventional support tools. The realization that it's not about deflecting cases, but about learning from customer interactions. That change not only leads to better customer understanding, but also transform support from a cost center into a strategic driver for growth. It's a trait remarkable software companies master. They aim to be different, not just better, by challenging industry assumptions about what matters. Secondly, they focus on the essence, ignoring must-have features to solve deeper problems. And lastly, they master the art of curiosity, learning from customer signals that others dismiss. And this leads to solutions that are both valuable and desirable, and that is noticed. So you can master these traits as well. And the first step? Simply read my book. I've made the electronic version available for free. Just visit theremarkableeffect.com to grab your copy, and inspiration will spark within 10 minutes. Back to the interview.
It was a little of education for the market. Now, but the good news is the market has completely realized what we were saying. And there are many, many companies doing what we're doing right now at this point. I mean, they've got even getting acquired by major companies. So the messaging and the idea, the philosophy that we had has really become a commonplace idea in the market right now, but there's a lot of education in the market.
Exactly. Well, that's the whole thing of credit category curation. And it's, it spells out trait number three in my book, you know, remarkable software companies aim to be different, not just better. And I think you made a very clear point there. So in that whole journey then, what has been the hardest nut to crack?
Oh my God, there's a lots of challenges. I mean, I would say as an entrepreneur, starting something new from scratch and taking the business to any degree of success is not an easy thing to do. I have tremendous respect for any entrepreneurs of any kind. Hardest nut to crack, as I was saying earlier, is the first thing is convincing there is a market opportunity exists here.
Yeah.
Right? That's a, especially for a new category, that's very, very difficult. There's really no comparables. Doing a TAM analysis is very difficult when you're doing a new category. Existing category, we know what the TAM is, what the total addressable market is. But for a new category, so investors are a little skeptical about investing in a new category. So that was a hard nut to crack back in those days, in the early days of the company.
How did you do that? You know, I mean, for me, it's even so you don't have to kind of invest or convince investors as long as you convince yourself that the opportunity is large enough, and then you can build a sustainable business.
The North Star is always the customers, right? I mean, what I saw was in the early days of SupportLogic, a lot of investors did not see the picture that we're going after, the vision we're going after, but the customers we were talking to, they were just getting super excited. So I saw a huge disconnect. So the ones that motivated me, and I also realized if customers are excited and investors are not seeing it, this is the right opportunity to go after. Because this is an opportunity that they're not going to fund. Not many companies are going to enter the market, and which means it's a huge advantage that you have as an entrepreneur to go conquer the market. So that's what we
exactly
did in the early days.
Yeah, I was hoping for an answer like that. So like, how do you find that opportunity? And you make a very strong point. If no one believes in it from a funding perspective, they're also not going to fund anyone else that's going to jump on the idea. And therefore, you're there, just exploring it yourself and become the category king. Well, talking the other way around then, since it's not a known thing, were there any challenges in explaining it to your potential customers for them to say, This is what I've been waiting for.
That's also a challenge. It's just like funding is a challenge. Convincing a customer to implement something new that they've not have a budget line item associated. Because the biggest risk you are running into when you're creating something new is inertia. Doing nothing is the safest, seems like a safest thing to do for any customer, right? I have never had this kind of a software before. Why should I have it? I have a CRM software. I can invest in CRM. But why would I need a tool like this that observes all the customer interactions and tells me the true voice of the customer? I have a survey software. Why should I replace my survey software, right? So the existing status quo is unseating it, but more importantly, inertia. I don't need to do anything. I'll just run support as it is, right? That is a challenge. And I think this is where the entrepreneur's storytelling, your personal experience, why you built a company, how this has really impacted you personally, that is pretty, very important. And in the early days, right, you're just looking for this handful of marquee customers who become your champion, who become your brand ambassadors. And once you see more and more companies adopting it, then it becomes a natural adoption. The product kicks in the market. So that's what I focused on. Like I was not too worried about, okay, I'm going to get 1,000 customers in a relatively short span of time. Let's focus on half a dozen customers and make them wildly, wildly successful. Right.
Yeah,
That's
exactly.
the strategy we took.
Yeah, well done. But yeah, you said we found the storytelling, and I completely agree with that. That is possibly the most powerful thing there is until you need a large sales team to start scaling it. But what triggered me was you say that why should you invest in a product? There's no line, no budget, a line item. There's nothing like this before. On the other hand, it is about the same thing, but just with another spin on it, whereby you say, okay, we build this system, but instead of going it, making it go this way, we make it go that way, and that's giving you all kind of benefits. Isn't this a positioning issue?
It's a positioning issue. So again, hindsight is 2020. Right now, there is no skepticism about AI, right? Everybody thinks AI is going to disrupt the world. And in fact, I think the pendulum has swung completely in the opposite direction. I distinctly remember in 2016 and in 2018, so much skepticism about AI. So when we go and pitch to customers, we have an AI technology that's going to understand customer sentiment, true voice of the customer. Everybody was super skeptical. They didn't want to invest in AI. It's complete opposite. Right now, the expectation is AI is we're going to achieve artificial general intelligence, which we're a little further away, but there is so much hype around that we're going to reach that very soon. Even basic artificial intelligence was just, I'm talking about 6, 7 years ago, there was so much skepticism. So that's another hurdle we have to crack. So even if you can tell the story and even we convince them there's going to be a strong ROI, we still have to prove the technology actually works.
True.
So this is where, again, making your first set of customers wildly, wildly successful and generating case studies from those customers, and they become the testimonials and they become your sellers, is the most powerful thing you can do. Because we have to
Exactly.
overcome not only category adoption, but also technology adoption.
Yeah, and it's the classic bell curve, the innovators that see it, that understand also that they are the first one, but it also is going to give them a competitive
Crossing the
advantage.
chasm.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's what you did. No, but from your point of view, I can instantly imagine, a lot of companies do their segmentation by, okay, it needs to be a company of this size and this structure, and they need to be in this region and so on. But it hasn't got to do anything with it. This is more about a right way, well, the belief that this is the right way going forward for a company.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I
And
mean, that's why I said, right? TAM analysis is when you're creating something new, the category does not exist. Entrepreneur's job is to create new markets, right? A market that did not exist, a need the customer did not even realize they had, a software spend they did not realize that they need to do. That's what an entrepreneur's job is. So
true.
the TAM way of approaching, I'm saying there is a huge market opportunity, therefore let's go build something there, is not necessarily the right approach or right advice I would give for entrepreneurs. go after a point of view that you have unique point of view that no one else has, and keep working on it, and you will see that as a huge market opportunity.
Exactly. And
Yeah.
I mean, it can be that there's maybe 100,000 customers out there from a TAM perspective, but at the end, like you say, you only need the first six first. And the
Right.
first six will bring you the next 12. And the next 12 will bring you the next, et cetera.
Yeah.
Because it grows from there. And a lot of companies take that TAM approach whereby, yeah, I'm not sure who they try to impress. But at the end, the only thing they need to do, particularly in the sales-led SaaS space, the selling to enterprise and so on, I mean, a lot of companies do very well if they have 50 to 100 deals a year. So, yeah, who's considered with or afraid about starting with a large TAM first? To the point, you started getting your first six, and then the first six became the first 12. What did you learn from getting to the first, let's say, 50 customers? And what I've learned is that you also do primarily the larger type companies, global enterprise, I see. What has been some takeaways that you didn't anticipate up front?
We had a hypothesis and a vision for what we want to go after, the philosophy that we want to go after, but we didn't know exactly what features and functionality customers would care about. Now, I come from the support domain. I did support for many, many years at VMware, so I thought I knew the space really, really well. I thought what the customers actually want and what they would like. And I was surprised left and right every time I was pitching something in a customer. So it's very, very important still to be very open-minded. Even if you know the domain really, really well, it's very important to go open-minded. So I'll give you a very clear example of that. So today we do sentiment analysis as part of a core part of our product, it's support logic. It's a feature everyone loves, every one of our customers love. But this was a feature was not even in the company's radar when we started. Today it's our bread and butter what we do. It was not even in the radar. And the reason it was not in the radar is I was under the impression as a support engineer, I thought every customer who called support, they're unhappy. What's the point in stating the obvious that they're unhappy? What's the point in, you know, if I read an email from a customer, I know why they're unhappy. Why should I highlight that sentiment? Right? I didn't see value in it. Absolutely not see any value in it. I thought there are other problems to tackle here, but not necessarily looking at customer sentiment in the customer communications. What I overlooked is, as an individual engineer, that's true. As an organization, it's very different because nobody has time to read through every customer communications. And even if you have a dozen support engineers, it's very difficult to keep track of all the customer sentiment. And also, you want to track sentiment over time across different conversational boundaries, even for the same customers over time, right? And look for patterns among sentiment. So there's lots of other value that emerges. And that became only clear after we put together a prototype in front of customer, and then we asked them what they think about it. And they came up with lots of interesting use cases. So that's how our product has been evolving. I mean, even now, I would say lots of new features we're building in the product is not because we think it's a great feature. It's really shaped by the voice of the customer, what we're seeing in the customer's conversations.
Makes sense. Like, that's the whole premise of building the software in the first place. You're using
Exactly.
it
Yeah.
yourself. I like that example, by the way. Thanks for sharing that. What have you seen as one of your biggest challenges to get traction? For example, the first six, was that obvious? Was that coming through word of mouth, or did you have to, yeah, bend some arms, I would say?
Actually, luckily for us, the first two customers were like big brand names, the very first two customers. And third customer ended up being a really large customer for us. And what was interesting, the third customer we closed, we didn't even do a demo. The second customer who used the product actually went and did the demo to the third customer without even telling us, because turns out they were friends. The support leaders in both organizations were friends. So he literally walked into their office and showed the demo with his own data set and everything and showed it to them, hey, look, this is what the product does. If you want, go talk to this person. I can make an intro. So we got an inbound from a really, really large company, and we closed the deal in relatively short span of time with zero marketing effort, zero outreach effort, purely from customer marketing. And that happens even now for us. A lot of our existing customers go join a new company, bring us there. or show a demo of a product to someone else and make a referral.
Exactly.
That was wonderful. But having said that, that's the thing really, really worked for us. But to make the product really work and attention to details, the workflows, emphasis on the design and user interface, in the early stage, I was very, very closely involved in the product design. Because I think founders who have the subject matter expertise need to get involved in product design.
True.
Because that's what really tells you, hey, I understand your problem set. That's why I'm emphasizing this. This I'm underemphasizing because it's less relevant for you. Because when you do that, the product speaks to your target persona. The target persona looks at, oh, actually, you understand me. You understand my daily workflows because you built the product in the way I actually want it. So that's very, very important. So I would say for any product CEO, don't shy away from getting involved in the design of the product, especially in the early days.
True. Yeah. Yeah, it needs to be like that. Actually, funny enough, I wrote a post on LinkedIn about what you just said. You know, a remarkable effect is when customers start bragging about your product more than you do.
Exactly. But that
which
has
is the
happened
case.
To us numerous times. Yeah. I mean, we often say that we are way more self-critical about our product than our customers are. Customers, the way they profusely talk about a product is very different from how we criticize. And I think that's the right approach. Internally, you have to criticize your product and so that you keep improving it, even though the customer's facing crisis.
Yeah. Now, I got a couple of questions around scaling and some of the lessons learned there. So knowing that you've been on a journey now for about 7 years, what did you do differently to succeed when others failed? Because I've seen, of course, there's been COVID and there's been these technology waves. It's not an easy thing these days to, well, first of all, start a company and then to kind of stay around for 7 years and just compound that success. Do you feel there was any moment where you say, okay, I went left, they went right? That was the difference?
I think all the time, I think the first thing I have to learn as a founder and CEO is start doubling and tripling down on your gut instincts. Because when you're working for someone else, you're automatically trained to suppress your instincts because you're following the orders, right? You're following the marching orders. And you may internally feel, no, that's not the right thing to do, but I should do it because it's what company is asking me to do it, right? Yeah. And when you are operating in that mode for a really, really long time, it gets very difficult to start trusting your inner instincts because you always think, you know what, someone else better has made the right decision. I should follow that. But when you are the person who's calling all the decisions, you will have to rely on your gut instincts very, very strongly. And sometimes, I would say often, your gut instincts may not align with what the industry is telling you. The gut instincts may not align with what the board is advising you. The gut instinct may not align with what your direct reports are telling you. So you have to start trusting yourself on your decision-making process because as a founder and CEO, you get inputs constantly from 360 degrees. You get inputs from the market, you get inputs from your customers, you get input from your board, you can input from your direct reports, you get inputs from your people that you're working for, not just your direct reports, but all the other employees you're working for. Everybody has a point of view and opinion.
Yeah.
It's your job is to be a sump and absorb all of it and then make your own judgment call. Right. So often you have to realize that you have a vantage point, a unique vantage point that not everyone in the company has. Their individual vantage point matters, but you have the bigger vantage point of seeing everybody's perspectives. So your decision, you have to have the trust to go with it. And that requires courage because if you're not used to making decisions like that, it can be very scary because you feel like, you know what, I'm going against the grain. And what if it's a wrong decision? So absolutely should not be afraid of making wrong decisions and absolutely should not be afraid of retracing your path back if your decision was wrong. And I've done that many times in the company. You have to go with conviction, but willing to change your opinion if the results are not.
Have you got an example of where you deliberately went against the grain and it turned out, like you said, okay, I knew this.
A lot of little decisions. I mean, product strategy decisions, like certain features we did not want to implement it at all because that's we thought was the right strategy. For instance, we for a long time we decided not to go after knowledge resolution problem set. So we told ourselves our focus is going to be observing customer interactions, extracting signals from customer interactions, providing workflows for harnessing those customer signals found in customer interaction. That's what we set ourselves as a target. But then we got a lot of employees and sometimes even customers saying, "Hey, why don't you build a product that can actually answer my customer questions?" Right? We decided consciously we're not going to focus on that, right? The technology was not there. Honestly, the technology was not there 8 years ago. If we went and spent our energy on the technology, we probably would have created something. But guess what? ChatGPT came now and made it very, very easy to do that. So now it's very easy to write a wrapper around ChatGPT and OpenAI and build that very, very simply.
Sure.
So the fact we decided not to do it actually saved us a lot of R&D costs right now for us. Now we can do a much better technology because we can use the latest and greatest development. So that's one example. There are many, many examples like that.
Got a good point. Because at the end, it's also something that, of course, people are asking for it, but it's also not going to differentiate you. And
Right.
now you can do it and say, okay, hey, I check the box as well. And I do an even a good
But what about, we
yeah.
have the functionality right now. We have a functionality and it's much better implementation than anything else out there because we started late. We didn't do it early on and didn't have the baggage.
When you're faced with conflicting priorities, I mean, you just highlighted that, the trust you got, have the courage. Do you have a method for making those tough calls?
I think this is another biggest skill for an entrepreneur and a CEO is prioritization. The number one thing I've learned is you cannot be firefighting everything. You have to be okay with letting some fires burn because as a CEO, you always have crisis everywhere. Everywhere you look, there is crisis. No functional group that you're dealing with is perfect. And if you're getting very, very focused on solving every little fire that's out there, you're going to miss the big picture, right? So you have to consciously set your brain saying, this is the problem that I'm going to focus for this particular quarter on a quarter basis. And I go deep in that quarter only on that problem at the expense of letting some other fires burn. And I know I need to get to that fire later, but I need to solve this one because if I don't solve this, it's going to sink the ship.
Yeah, true.
So that's what I need to focus on. So you have to think through the framework of what is going to sink the ship. What is going to really, if you don't focus on it, what is going to sink your ship? Or what is the one that's going to have the biggest impact, a needle mover for business? That requires a little bit of thinking. You have to step yourself back and think very, very broadly, like, okay, I know I have all these 100 problems, but if I solve this one particular problem, is it going to change the needle or not?
Yeah, that's true. Which one is going to give, make the others go better as well? Root cause searching. So you're in the scale phase right now. What is an obstacle that you had to overcome in scaling the business that you've been most proud of achieving?
So I was always been an individual contributor, right? Prior to being a founder and CEO, I was an individual contributor, right? So the number one thing you learn is delegation in the company. And so I'm at this point right now that are certain parts of the business, I don't even have to look deeper. I just let the business run by their business unit and their leader is running their organization. I don't need to go look deep into it at all, right? That is not an easy thing to accomplish, especially for our founders, right? So that's a skill you have to acquire, but also more than skill, you have to hire the right talent that you trust that can run the show for you so that you can do the orchestration, high-level orchestration, and not really get into the details. But having said that, there are places where you need to roll up your sleeves and get into the details. So you cannot just be an orchestrator all the time. There are places where you have to roll up the sleeves and say, you know what? I'm going to get into the details as much as possible, but you can only pick one problem at a time. You can't be doing this. This is going back to the earlier point I was saying, pick one particular problem for a quarter or for 6 months and focus on that and go completely deep into that. But let the other groups run by itself and have a trusted people running it.
Wise lesson. The whole thing of focus allows you to indeed go deeper and solve it in a different way. In relation to that, running, making sure that the business can run without you, What has been a metric that you stopped tracking that you initially thought was crucial?
So all this thing evolves with time. There will be a phase of company where you would be focused on one metric, and then the next year you would completely, the metric is not even in your radar. I think
True.
the way I see it is tracking metrics all is about focusing on improving that. If you think that's a problem you need to fix, then you focus on the metric, then you keep on improving that metric. If that's not a problem, that's not going to be a needle mover, it's okay. Don't need to obsess about the metric. Ignore the metric and focus on a different metric. So it honestly varies for me from time to time. Like very, very
Yeah.
early on, started focusing on metrics like adoption metrics, right? Until we reached product market fit, adoption metric was a key component. We still track adoption metric, but we're not so obsessed about adoption metric like we used to be in the past. We track net dollar retention numbers very, very obsessively, right? We track growth numbers, all kinds of growth numbers. We track efficiency numbers. Especially now in the last 2 years, the market has been putting a lot of emphasis on efficient growth. Efficiency is a top metric on mind for us right now. So it varies, really varies time to time.
Yeah, completely agree with that. Yeah, the last 2 years it did definitely be an efficiency game. What has been, I mean, talking about success, you start with the point of view. You envision the company to achieve something further down the road. How is it the definition of success changed or evolved since you started?
I don't think the definition of success has drastically changed. The metrics to get there, that has
Okay.
changed. The definition of success is about impact. You create a software, let's say it's the world's best software, nobody using it, there's no impact, right? There's only five customers that are using it, there's not much impact. You want to make this as a category and you want to make it look like it's a well-accepted phenomenon in the industry, it takes, that's what impact is. So to me, that is success. And have we done that? No, it's still a long way to go, right? We still have a lot more customers to influence and go in this direction. But to get to that success, you have to do it in stages. Stage one, stage two, stage three. What are the things you want to do? Stage one, get the five customers. Stage two, get the 50 customers and make it achieve product market fit, right? Stage three, you figure out how to scale that so that the product becomes self-serviceable. There's so many different ways to look at how to solve the problem. So that's how I'm looking at it.
Very well. And I like what you're saying there. You know, at the end, it's about impact, and that impact is about your customer, not yourself. I mean, I
Right.
typically talk about if you measure success by the impact you help your customers create, value will come your way in amounts that you cannot even forecast for. It's a pity that not more companies do that. Last question then. From the tidbits of wisdom that you've gained over time now running the company, well, first of all, being an individual contributor at VMware and later on starting the company that you're running now for about 8 years, Support Logic. What is a do and what is a don't that you'd like to share with tech entrepreneurs aspiring a similar success?
I think I've spoken to other entrepreneurs also, and I've heard this consistently. Don't delay decisions. More specifically, don't delay firing decisions. And this is something a lot of entrepreneurs grapple with. We struggle with letting go of people who are not the right fit for the company because there is a lot of stigma associated with it. There's a lot of guilt associated with it sometimes. And there's also a lot of empathy associated with it. Rightfully, you need to have empathy with your employees as well, right? But you cannot do this at the expense of the business. Sometimes you hang on to the wrong people way too long, and that it really, really impacts the business, which means for the purpose of one person, you are impacting the lives of the other people in the business who are depending on your business. So that is something I would urge entrepreneurs to make those decisions, tough decisions, very, very quickly. There are two kinds of hiring decisions you can make, they say, right? One is hiring the wrong person, and the other one is mishiring the right person. There's not a right person, but you did not hire him. You let
Yeah,
it,
yeah.
right? I think hiring the wrong person is more risky than anything
Yeah.
else, right?
That's true.
I mean, so which means if you're passing on the right candidate, because that's okay. That's okay. That's going to have less impact than having the wrong person in the seat for a long time. So that's the thing I would urge entrepreneurs to do very, very quickly. Don't ignore your inner instincts. Pay attention to it. You will be surprised how often your instincts are correct. Your gut instincts, especially.
Yeah, exactly. And then have the courage to make them come out. Well, thank you very much for sharing all the wisdom, telling the story about the mission that you're on, building the company. Love the vision behind it. Indeed, customer success should be a strategic driver for growth. And luckily, there's technology now to do that. Where can people go to find out more about SupportLogic or to say hi to you?
So they can go to supportlogic.com, which is the company website. If they're more interested in reading my book, the book is called Support Experience, How Innovative Companies Are Using AI to Win the Hearts and Minds and Wallets of Customers. They can go to supportexperience.ai.
Very well. Thank you very much. I'll keep following you on the next 8 years of the journey. Would be a good one in 5 years' time to come back and just discuss what happened since. Thank you for making the time available today.
Thank you, John. Pleasure.
Pleasure. And this ends my conversation with Krishna, and I hope you enjoyed it. And if so, please leave a review on iTunes. And if it inspired you, please share it with other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that you have in your network. Other than that, thank you for tuning into this podcast. I had the honor to speak to Krishna Rajaraja, founder and CEO of SupportLogic. As said, the goal that I have in this podcast is twofold. Firstly, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. And secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what is required to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. Before I close, I have two more comments to make. If you know other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that have a story worth sharing, please send me an email at ton.dobby@valueinspiration.com. Building the momentum all starts with revealing the ideas, and that starts with you. And if you want to know more about my book, or you're interested in joining the Remarkable Effect tribe, please visit my website at www.valueinspiration.com. Thanks for tuning in. And you could do me a big favor by rating the podcast on iTunes or provide me with your feedback directly. I'll see you shortly on a new episode.